Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name is Pat Rowe, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here, glad to be sober, and it's an honor to be asked to do this. I'm a little uncomfortable, though. I mean, I'm following some really good speakers. You know, it's intimidating. I love Alcoholics Anonymous so much, and I want to be a... Oh, my God, I can see myself in the thing over there. Oh. That's a lot of Pat Yo. Oh, man. I want to be a good representative of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's important to me. This is the very thing that has saved my life, and I just want to be a good example in whatever I'm doing for AA. I'm tasked with talking about step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. When I was a kid, when I was growing up, I believed in God. I went to church. When I was a young preteen or so, I was very involved in a church youth group, and those things were important to me. I liked that. But then I started drinking. When I was 13, I started drinking, and I quit going to that youth group, and I didn't go to church unless my mother just dragged me and made me go. And but I always said I believed in God, but I never had any connection after that. I think when I was young, I did. I think I felt things. You know, I remember when I got confirmed, feeling, in a connection somehow with God. But I never, once I started drinking, it was gone. But if you had asked me, I would say, yeah, sure, of course I believe in God. But I didn't pray. Well, you know, that, oh God, get me out of this one and I swear I'll never do it again. I said those, but not the real connection with God. I started drinking when I was 13, and that first night I drank because I don't fit in anywhere and I don't feel comfortable anywhere, and I was at a party and I was not feeling comfortable, and so somebody offered me a rum and coke and I drank it, and you know, the magic happened. I fit in, or well, I felt like I did. I probably didn't, but I felt like I did, and it was magic. Somebody else talked about it. I could dance and, you know, talk to you and make you laugh, and it was fabulous, but I drank too much. I blacked out, I passed out, and I woke up in bed the next morning with a Marine that I didn't know. I didn't mean to do that, you know. I was embarrassed and ashamed. My friends knew how my evening had ended up, and I felt terrible about that. I was terrified that I'd get pregnant. I had bad feelings. But I drank again the very next night. The magic that alcohol did for me was worth any price that I was going to pay, and the price was going to get bigger. Although that first night did sort of set the tone for how my life was going to be. As I like to describe it, when I drink, I become friendly. And so I developed this reputation in high school for being a friendly girl. And that's not how I wanted people to think. I wanted people to admire and respect me. I wanted to, I meant to grow up and get married and stay married to the same person and live a decent life. But I'm 13, 14, 15 years old, and I kind of know in my heart of hearts already that that's not going to happen. And I did get married when I was 18 because somebody asked. Got divorced when I was 18 and a half. That's a mistake. You know, I went after that divorce. I moved back in briefly with my parents, and then I grew up in Newport Beach in Southern California. And excuse me, after that divorce, I moved back in with my parents for a little while and got my financial act together. And then I moved up to LA, 50 miles up the road, and got a job and an apartment. And now I'm on my own, really, for the first time in my life. And I'm drinking every single day. Getting drunk every single night. I was working as a secretary in a trucking company, and I drank with these truck drivers, and I behaved there the way I'd behaved in high school, which is to say, before I left that job, not even a year later, I knew most of those truck drivers. God was nowhere in my life. Well, I think God was there, but I wasn't acknowledging that there was a God. I never thought about God. I thought a lot about when I was sober in between, you know, drunks. I don't know that it's not sobriety as we know it. When I was dry, let's say, in between drunks, I would think about how I was living my life. I'd have these little moments of, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm doing this, you know. But I don't remember ever praying. I don't remember ever, except, as I said earlier, for that, oh, God, get me out of this one, and I swear I'll straighten up, you know. One time when I was out drinking, I woke up in a Skid Row hotel room with a man that didn't speak any English. And I couldn't even imagine, you know, where I met him or how that happened. I remember it was a weekday. I had to go to work. It was, you know, it's like 5 or 6 in the morning or something, and I have to go to work in an hour. And I put my clothes on and went down the hall to find the bathroom to pull myself into some kind of condition to show. Remember those days when you showed up for work wearing what you wore yesterday? She remembers. And so I'm trying to, you know, get myself together to show up to work. And I went back to the room to get my things, and this man held out some money to me because that's what he thought I was. Apparently it's what I was. I took his money, but I didn't. Did not feel very good about it. I remember walking down the stair. There was like this stairway that went down. The room was on the second floor, and there was a stairway that went down right past the desk, where, you know, the registration desk where you check into the hotel. And I can remember walking down that stair and the clerk at the behind the desk looking at me. And I can see the look on his face right now. You know, I wasn't thinking about God. There was no God in my life, none. I remember getting in the car when I left there and feeling like I was about 100 years old. And I knew that the worst of it was I was probably going to do it again, maybe tomorrow night. You know, I knew it already. I think I was 19 years old when that happened, somewhere around there. You know, I didn't get sober till I was almost 31, so had some fun years to come. You know, it just got, there was just more of it. You know, I went through my mariachi phase. I discovered this bar in San Juan Capistrano, which is not exactly around the corner from where I lived. It was, I don't know, an hour and a half drive, maybe 2 hours. I don't remember exactly. It was quite a ways. And they had a mariachi band that played there every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night. The band came there. There were like 8 or 10 guys in this band, and they came and they played at the bar those nights, and they stayed in a local motel. And then on Sunday night after they finished, you know, the evening, they would get in their car and drive back to Tijuana, presumably to their wives and many children. I'm not sure because none of them spoke English, but I somehow discovered this establishment, and I was there every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night for, the better part of a year. I don't know exactly. I love speakers who are very sort of methodical about it. And then in 1961, on a Tuesday, stuff happened. I know it happened. I don't always know the right order of how things happen, but the memories are there. Anyway, so I discovered this place, and I'm there every Thursday. The first thing I'd do is I'd hand the bartender my purse, and he would put it behind the bar because you know how we are women. We'd lose things, and I'm concerned, so concerned about my purse tonight. You know, it's like, whatever. But I'm in a bar, and I'll just leave it anyway. So I'd hand the bar. Everybody knew me. You know, he'd put the purse back there, and I'd sit at the bar. There was a little dance floor where the patrons of the bar could dance to this music. And at some point I'd sit at the bar, and I'd request those sad songs. You know, and I'd sort of cry and. God, it was pathetic. And then at some point during the evening, one of these mariachi players would ask me to dance. And I can remember moving around the dance floor thinking that all of you, the other patrons in the bar, are, stop laughing, Sharon, are looking at me with awe and admiration. Now, I'm sure they were looking at me, but I don't think awe and admiration had anything close to that. You know, I knew that mariachi band. I knew them all. Never encountered God in that place ever. You know, I was sober about 10 or, I don't know, some years, and I was speaking at a meeting not far from there, and I got there really early. I had some time to kill, and I thought, I wonder if that place is still there, and I drove around and found it. It's still there, or it was then. They'd kind of shined it up a little bit. It looked a little better than when I was going there, but it was dark. It was nighttime. I sat in my car across the street, and I could sort of see through the door, you know, a little bit, and because there was light on in there, and I sat in my car for, I don't know, 10 minutes or something, trying, you know, thinking about that time, and I couldn't remember one really happy, fun time in there. I couldn't remember one really great dance or one really great evening or one even really great laugh. Every memory I could come up with was kind of awful, you know, kind of degrading, really, you know. It was awful. And yet I went there every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night, I think for the better part of a year. I don't know why I stopped going there. I can only assume that something happened by my obviously diminishing standards that was so terrible that I just couldn't go back anymore, because that's pretty much what I do. You know, I leave places because it gets so uncomfortable that I can't face you anymore. And so I assume that something like that happened there. But mercifully, I don't remember what it was. I drank a lot in blackouts, and frankly, I'm kind of grateful for it, because I remember enough, and it wasn't good. There's no pretty social drinking in my story. I called myself a social drinker, but there is no social drinking there. There just isn't. Obviously God, you know, was not part of my life. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, but, you know, by then I'd spent the last few years, I went to jail. I mean, this stuff, you know, it just gets worse. If you're an alcoholic, it gets worse. And so by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have any trouble with steps one and two. I mean, it was very clear, you know, that there was a problem here. I mean, at first I had a little trouble with step two, because there's an implication there that you're insane, and I didn't care for that, but my sponsor sat down and reminded me of a couple of things that I had told her, and I hadn't even hadn't done a fourth step yet, so she didn't even really know most of it, but she knew enough just from the conversation that we'd had, and she, you know, reiterated a couple of those things to me and said, does that sound like sane behavior to you? And I had to acknowledge that it did not. And so that brought me to step three. Now, I believe in God. When I got the big book, I didn't read the chapter to the agnostic, because I believe in God. So I don't need to read that chapter. I have had no connection whatsoever to God since I was maybe 11 or 12, maybe. But I profess to believe in God. So my sponsor tells me, you know, I need to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. Well, how do I do that? Okay, God, take it. You know, I'm yours. Nothing happens. My experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is that nothing ever happens if all I'm doing is saying a prayer. There's always action involved, you know. The short answer to what's the action involved is we take the rest of the steps. It is the action involved in step three, but you want me to talk a little longer than that, so I'll elaborate a little bit on that. Or I don't know, maybe you want to go to bed, but you're going to hear more. So I said to my sponsor, okay, I'm willing to do this. I'm not sure I believe this, but, you know, you're going to help me out a little bit here. So she said, I want you to pray every morning and every night. In the morning, ask God to keep you sober today, and at night, thank him for keeping you sober today. Okay, I'll do that. So I did it. I didn't feel anything. I was married to my second husband when I got sober, and I was embarrassed about praying, so I always did it when he was in the other room. Now, I've behaved like a drunken pig through our whole marriage, but I'm afraid he might see me praying. Think about that. You know, we're a little twisted. So she said, say that prayer morning and night. So I said it, and I said to her after, you know, I'm not feeling anything. She said, I don't care, just say it. And so I said it. I said it because I knew if I stopped, that was going to be the day she'd say, now you're saying that prayer every day, right? So I just, okay, I'll just say it every day. So what are the actions involved here? I'm praying every day. I'm calling my sponsor. I'm starting to take these steps. She tells me to be of service. I don't want to be of service. I'm struggling here. I was a big crier when I was new. I cried all the time. I thought that I had the saddest life of anybody who ever came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I really, not little, you know, tears, great wrenching dramatic sobs. That's who I am. And so I help others. I don't care about others. I don't, and besides, I got nothing to give, you know. But I started doing these things because she told me to do it. She said, it doesn't matter how you feel, just do it. I promise you, if you keep doing this and keep saying that prayer, keep asking God, you know, that keep turning your will and your life over to his care every day, it will come. That doesn't make any sense to me, but I did it because I, thank God, didn't have a better idea. Thank God. I was desperate enough just to do these stupid things and pray when my husband was in the bathroom or somewhere where he wouldn't see me, and I kept coming to meetings. And then little things started to happen. I remember one day I had gone on a panel with, five of us had taken a panel meeting to some, I don't know, place in San Pedro, and you know, put on a little meeting for the people and whatever it was. We didn't have treatment centers then, I don't think, but whatever it was. And after the panel, we came back to Westwood, and I remember we were in the Bratskeller restaurant, five of us sitting at this table eating pie and coffee and laughing and talking. And I was sitting at a table with those people. I can see it. I can see the table in my mind's eye right now where we were all sitting. And it occurred to me that I was sitting at a table with friends, laughing and talking and having a good time, and I was sober. And I almost started to cry sitting at the table because I couldn't remember that ever, ever having happened. I didn't have friends really much growing up. You know, I've sponsored people who say, what do I tell my friends, you know, that I'm going to AA? And my answer is, I have no idea because I didn't have any when I got here. There was nobody I needed to explain it to. I mean, my husband, but, you know, none of my friends were knocking on my door because there weren't any friends. Anyway, I'm at this table and I'm having this little spiritual experience that I realize, wow, maybe this is working. I mean, it was here and gone. You know what I mean? The moment was here and gone. Well, evidently not, because 44 years later, here I am talking about it, and the hair is standing up on the back of my neck as I'm telling the story all these years later. It was a big moment, and I started having little ones like that. You know, I remember one night, I was about 3 months sober, and this guy, Larry, he used to say an old timer. I don't know, I think he had 9 more months than me or something. I said hello to him and asked him how he was. He asked me how I was, and I started to tell him. I cried and, you know, made this big dramatic thing about how sad my life was, and, you know, it's all so tragic, and he cut me off. He said, I don't want to, he had listened to it many times before, and he said, I don't want to listen to that. Why don't you go find a newcomer to talk to? And he pointed to a girl in the back of the room. He said, that girl in the red dress over there is at her very first meeting. Why don't you just march over and say hello? I clearly remember thinking that I didn't care if the girl in the red dress lived or died, that I wish Larry would die. But I knew if I didn't do it, he would tell my sponsor that I hadn't done it. So this shouldn't take but a moment. I'll just go over and say hello real quick. So I go over to this girl, and the girl who had, Alex D, had 12-stepped this girl and brought her to the meeting, and she said, oh, Pat, I've been waiting for you. This is this girl's first meeting, and I've been waiting for you to talk to her. She had this big fight with her husband about coming to AA, and I knew you were the exact right person to talk to her. Well, no, actually, I fight with my husband every single night before I go to a meeting, every night. We are fighting. Just to be clear, we had a terrible marriage before. I cheated on him all the years we were married, up until I was sober a while, But so now we're just fighting. We got a new topic. You know, we're now fighting about AA. And so this Alex is telling me this girl's fighting with her husband. I knew you could talk to her and help her. And I'm like, I got nothing. You know, I got nothing. I missed that I was sober in my mind. I kind of missed that I was sober. That was something. That was a big something. This girl wasn't sober, but 5 minutes. I was sober, whatever it was, 3 months at the time or so. But I'm standing in front of this girl, and I'm thinking, I got nothing. But I'm standing in front of a girl at her first meeting. I should try to be positive here. So I opened up my mouth, and I heard myself say, keep coming back. It gets better a day at a time. Okay, so I've just lied to a newcomer. It's not better. It's not better at all. Well, I was sober. That was better. But again, I kept overlooking that. But I had another one of those moments, another one of those little spiritual nudges. You know, there was a center aisle in the room like this, and I know I didn't talk to this girl more than probably 30 seconds. I wouldn't have, you know. But I turned and I was walking back down that center aisle, and I realized it was the first time in that 3 months or however long it was that I was sober, that I was at the meeting in that hour. I had to get to every meeting an hour early, sponsored direction. It was the first time in that hour period of time that I was at the meeting and I wasn't crying. And the reason was very clear to me. The reason I wasn't crying is because for this brief little moment, I tried to say something positive to this girl that was newer than me, and I felt better. You know, it turns out when I'm thinking about you, I'm not thinking about me at the same time, and any time I'm not thinking about me, I'm feeling better. It was another one of those little spiritual moments. I got it. That walk. I mean, literally, I stopped in my tracks halfway down the aisle because I say it's kind of like God just reached down and hit me on the head to get my attention, and I got it. I would love to tell you that I've happily worked with others from that moment to this, but that would be a lie. But it worked then. It works today. You know, it always works. You know, it says in our literature that when all else fails, working with another alcoholic will save the day. It may not say it exactly that way. I hate it when I start to say as it says in the book, because I almost always misquote it. But it says something like that. So, let's see. I remember one time. Again, these little moments, and these little moments kept me going, you know. I'm saying the prayers, but I'm not feeling connected to God, really. I'm not feeling like he's really listening to me. But I'm sober, and I'm having these little moments. Vince and I were living in Pasadena, and this is later on. I don't know how long I was sober, maybe 6 or 7 years. I don't know. It doesn't matter, really. We were living in Pasadena, and I worked in L.A., and so I drove to work down the Pasadena freeway, past Dodger Stadium, through downtown to get to my office. I'd been driving that drive every day for, I don't know, a year, and always the traffic stopped. You know, it's rush hour traffic, and it always stopped just before I would get to Dodger Stadium. It would stop, and then it would be, you know, stop-go until we got through downtown. Like I say, I'd been doing this for a long time, and I'm sitting in the car one day at that spot on the freeway, and I look over to the right. Now, the freeway at that point is sort of up, and then down below is, I think it's Figueroa, goes along there, and I'm sitting in my car, and I look down, and there on Figueroa is a bar that I worked as a go-go dancer in. It is the worst, seediest bar I ever worked in. I mean, it was really a horrible, horrible place, and some terrible things happened in there. And I'm sitting in my car. I've just left my nice house in Pasadena. I've said goodbye to my husband, who I love, who I'm faithful to. I am going to a job where they respect me and appreciate the work that I do for them and pay me well for it, and where I behave and don't sleep with all my coworkers. And I'm looking at this place where these terrible things, where I did these terrible things. You can't get from there to here. You can't. And yet here I am, you know, in this car up here. I couldn't believe it, you know. I started to get it. God really is listening, I guess is the way I thought of it. He really is hearing me, you know. I mean, I believe today. I just said this to a girl I sponsor. Sometimes my prayers are, okay, God, you already know what I want here, so I'm not even going to mention that, because I know that you know, but please let me be okay with whatever the outcome might be. You know, I've learned to do that, but I was just sort of gradually getting there back when these things were starting to happen. You know, this makes it sound like everything's just going swimmingly, like I get sober and each day it's getting, you're laughing at me, Don. It's getting better and better and I'm acting better and better. Yeah, no, it didn't quite work that way. I believe I told you that I cheated on my then husband, my second husband, all the time we were married. Now I'm newly sober, and it had not occurred to me that I was going to stop cheating on him. I mean, it's kind of what I do. I just hadn't thought about it. I had noticed. Now he thought that I was coming to AA to meet men, which was not a bad guess, except I wasn't actually cheating on him right that minute, and it really kind of annoyed me that he was accusing me of something I wasn't really doing right then. And also, the men in AA appeared not to be interested in me, which hurt my feelings quite a bit. So I felt, again, sorry for myself. But the happy day came when I believe I was 10 months sober. This newcomer gentleman, with a Fu Manchu mustache and a shaved head, hit the front door of our meeting hall. I spotted him. I believe I leapt across a chair or two to introduce myself to him, and my sponsor noticed, you know. And so I go over to my sponsor, and she said, "Let's not forget, Pat, that you're a married woman." And I said, "Yeah, but I am so unhappy." And she said, "Nonetheless, you're married, and as long as you're married, I expect you to act married." Well, I don't see this as a problem. I'll get divorced. She said, no, we in Alcoholics Anonymous don't feel it's a good idea to make major moves in our first year of sobriety. You get all that we and our. This is my life we're talking about. And it's like the royal we, you know. And she said, you just stay married and act married. Excuse me. Excuse me one second. Now, this is where I started to see God's will. Why would God get him sober in my home group if he didn't mean for us to be together? I knew you'd understand. So we began this little, I kind of refer to it as the death dance now. It starts with deep, meaningful glances at each other across the room during meetings, and then we're kind of brushing up against each other in the coffee line, and then he's walking me to my car after the meeting, and then I'm parking further and further away from the meeting, and it's a little tiny bit complicated. I'm a newcomer. I mean, I'm married. We're not going to my place. He's a newcomer. He doesn't have a place, but we're pretty resourceful people, and I was working at a record company in Hollywood, and he was very conveniently also working in Hollywood at a porn bookstore. I arranged this long lunch hour at work one day for somebody to cover for me, and he didn't have a car either, so I picked him up at the bookstore, and we went to a motel and got to know each other better, and I dropped him off at the bookstore that afternoon and was driving back to my office, and it occurred to me in the car that I was 10 months sober and I was living exactly the way I'd always lived. The only reason that hadn't happened sooner than 10 months sober is nobody had asked. Sadly. I knew I was in a lot of trouble that day. My sponsor had been really, really clear in her direction about this guy. I was terrified to tell her what had happened because she had been so clear, but I'd been sober long enough to know I want what you have, and I've seen enough of these little glimpses of it, these little moments that I've been telling you about, that I want more of that. And so now this is what I do when I've, you know, done something I shouldn't do. The minute my sponsor walked in the meeting hall door, I practically knocked her down. I have to talk to you right now. And she said, could I just put my purse down, please? And so I told her what I'd done, and she said, you know, Pat, I don't think you're a woman who could cheat on her husband and stay sober. And you do not have to live that way anymore if you don't want to. Here's the thing. I've never wanted to live that way, drunk or sober. I never felt good drunk coming out of a motel or wherever I was. You know, that never felt good. Wanting to change doesn't make anything happen. I don't get how you in Alcoholics Anonymous are going to help me change this. She suggested that I pray and ask God for help and strength. And she said, here's the deal. You ask God for help and then you stay away from that guy, period. I heard for the first time, really heard that line that is read in almost every meeting I go to, half measures avail us nothing. And I knew for me, in my particular case, that this was going to be the most important thing probably that I was going to do for my sobriety, that this was going to be the make it or break it, so to speak, for me. I knew that I needed to find a way not to live that way anymore. And it had to start right now with this particular guy. And so I stayed away from him a day at a time. I didn't call him on the phone. I didn't take his calls a day at a time when I didn't drive by that bookstore. A day at a time when I saw him in meetings, I shook hands with a locked elbow. If you're new, this means that we didn't get closer than the entire length of my arm. I thought I should explain to him what was happening, and I ran that idea by my sponsor, and she said, oh no, I think he'll get the idea. It seemed unnecessarily cruel to me, but I really hurt her, and so I did it 100% her way. And of course the obsession passed, because obsessions always pass, but the really good news for me is that I stopped living that way. You know, that obsession passed. I didn't do that anymore. I didn't know that I could change. That's when I really started to believe that I was honestly turning my will and my life over to God. It's the first time that there was like almost like a tangible thing I could see. This is really happening, and it really works. You know, I'm going to digress a minute. I was so moved by Mari's talk on the traditions. If you missed it, you missed a good one. But in relation to this story that I just told you, after that incident happened, a few months later, I got a better job, and I left that company, and I went on to a better job. But I stayed in touch with my friend at work there, in fact, the one who had covered for me that day, that, you know, I was taking this long lunch. And so we would get together once in a while, have lunch and talk. And about a year later, I heard through a third mutual friend that this first lady's husband had developed a drinking problem, and she had taken him to some church in the hopes that his drinking problem might be solved. And when I heard that, I thought, wow, wonder why she didn't go to AA or Al-Anon. I told her a lot about AA. What she saw about AA is that it's a place where people cheat on their spouses. You know, it really made me, for the first time, think about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not make Alcoholics Anonymous an attractive place for that family to go. You know, this is a program of attraction, and I did not, I was not an attraction for that family. I don't know if he ever got sober or not. I hope he did, but if he did, it's in spite of me. It really made me think for the future, you know, whenever, if I'm going to let people know that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have an obligation to behave in a manner that would make it an attractive place for them to go or to send somebody they love. Anyway, I digress, but that just came to my mind, and so I said it. I have the podium, so I can say whatever I want, I guess. So these little things keep happening over the years, you know, and it seems like whenever I have a little doubt, something, you know, some little thing happens. I remember some years later, Vince, this would be, for those of you who don't know me, this would be my third and final husband. The love of my life. We met in Alcoholics Anonymous. My second husband, who I was married to when I got sober, was got sick, had cancer, and died when I was 3 years sober. In that 3-year period of time, I had an opportunity, because my sponsor told me to make amends to him. And the way I did that was by being a kind and loving wife. So anyway, now I'm married to Vince, and which wouldn't have been possible had I not learned how to be a wife back there. So now Vince and I are married, and we're having the good life. And then he had his first heart attack, and he was in the hospital. And I thought he was going to die. And a couple of weeks before that, maybe 3 weeks before that, I don't know, I had met a newcomer at my Monday night meeting. She was brand new. She'd never been to Alcoholics Anonymous before. She smelled of alcohol. we were kind of fighting over her, you know. I won, and so I'm her sponsor. And so now I'm sponsoring this girl. She's now 2 or 3 weeks sober. Vince is in the hospital. I'm there a lot, you know, with him. I worked for him at the time, and we had to, the company was the two of us. There were no other employees. And so periodically I would be with him in the hospital room, and then I'd go to the payphone. This is a long time ago. Payphones, for you younger people, were these things that hung on the wall that, anyway. And in the hospital, they were low because I guess because people in wheelchairs can reach them. I don't know. But that meant if you're not in a wheelchair, you're kind of bending down because the thing doesn't stretch up this, whatever. So periodically, I would go down the hall, and I would call the office to see if there's messages and try to keep make it sound like business is, you know, going on as usual. And there would be calls from women I sponsor, guys that he sponsored, you know, concerned about us, you know, calling to see how we are, is there anything we can do, that kind of stuff. And then there'd be a call from this girl, this newcomer, and it would be, you know, this just pathetic, horrible, sad, for example, hi, I'm really sorry to bother you. I know you're going through a terrible time, but I think I might drink because my imaginary boyfriend did, now imaginary is my word, he didn't know that he was her boyfriend, so that isn't that imaginary? I don't know. Anyway, I think, you know, she's going to drink, and so I'd be listening to this, and I think, okay, I got to call her back. So I'd call her back, and, you know, I'd give her some simple direction or, you know, kind of talk her off the rooftop, you know, and see you at the meeting tonight and whatever, and we'd hang up, and I'd go back and be with Vince, and then a little later, I'd, you know, an hour or so later, I'd come back and call for messages, and there she'd be again with some new, you know, so I'd call her back, and that went on. Vince got out of the hospital, recovered completely, got out of the hospital, and this girl would have been, I think it was 35 days sober that she would have been, and she called me and left a message that said, well, thank you very much for all your help, but Alcoholics Anonymous is much too hard, and I'm not coming back. And I listened to that message, and I thought, you ungrateful. I stood in that hospital calling you when my husband was maybe dying in the next room, worrying about you, thinking about you, trying to help you stay sober, and this is the thank. I mean, I really kind of worked up a steam here. And then it occurred to me that God picked the best possible 35 days he could have picked to give me that newcomer. You know, when I was going through the scariest, hardest time, he gave me that girl to think about. I got to remember out loud who I am several times a day with that girl. You know, I'm an alcoholic. I am that girl on the other end of the line. I can't do this, and yet I can because I've been doing it with you. You know, God has been, I was going to say dragging, and that's kind of maybe accurate, kind of dragging me along, you know. To do this, I really understood clearly, again, God is working in my life. I have turned my will and my life over to him, you know. That's not to say that, I'll tell you another one I like. Years later, Vince was sick again, and he had cancer at the time, and I really thought he was good. Just for those of you who don't know me, he did die of a heart attack some years later. But at this time, he had cancer, and I thought everybody thought he was going to die. He was really, really sick. And so I was at the hospital. He was in the City of Hope, and I was there, and it was just a bad day. You know, it was just a really bad day. And I thought, I need to call some. He was kind of half asleep, and I thought, I need to call somebody. I can't just walk through the rest of this day by myself. I need to call somebody. Again, it's the action. I'm praying by now. God, please help us. But I know that I need people, live people, so to speak. So I step out in the courtyard and I call my friend Rita, and her voicemail. I don't think it was maybe voicemail. I was going to say answering machine, but maybe this was by now we had voicemail. I don't know. Anyway, I called her and I said, "Hi, it's Pat Yo." And I burst into tears. Had I not said my name, I would have hung up because I couldn't talk. I was just, you know, just out of control. And but I said my name clearly in the beginning, so I felt obliged to stay on there to try to say something that would make some sense. And I finally just gave up and hung up. And I went back in the room with Vince. Now, by the time I went back in the room with Vince, I had stopped crying. And Didn't quite understand that right away, but I sat there with him for a few minutes, and he was still sleeping, so I thought, you know, I really need to call Rita back, and that's a terrible message to leave on somebody's phone. And so I called back. I got her voicemail again, and I said, "Hey, Rita, it's Pat. I just wanted to tell you, please disregard my prior message. I'm feeling much better now. Thank you." And here's the thing about that. It didn't matter that Rita wasn't home. What mattered is that I picked up the phone. What matters is that I took the action. You know, I asked God for help. I reached out to you because that is always the action I'm supposed to be taking. You know, when in doubt, speak to another alcoholic. That's like in gold in my brain. You know what I'm saying? And so I felt better. It's not like Rita was going to have some magic answer. You know, it's just that, again, I remember who I am. I'm an alcoholic. I better call a sober alcoholic here. I'm out of my mind crazy right now, so I better call a sober alcoholic. And so I did. And again, you know, God is there. Sometimes I've stopped in even in longer term sobriety. I've forgotten that I've turned my will and my life over to God. That seems impossible, even when I say it. But I'll give you a couple of examples. When Vince died, I was, I don't know, 36 years sober or something. I stopped praying, and I didn't notice it at first. I think it was, I don't even know how long it was, maybe a month, maybe 6 weeks, I don't know. But one day, I realized I have not prayed since Vince died. That's not good. That is not good. And so I tried to pray, and I couldn't. I just could not pray. I'm not sure why. I think part of it maybe is we often prayed together. Vince and I often prayed together, and so I imagine that probably was part of it. It doesn't really matter why. What mattered is that I wasn't doing it. And so I went to I was going to a women's meeting at the time, a little small women's meeting. And I shared about it in that meeting, and I was really, I mean, I cried, and I was kind of embarrassed because there's newcomers in that meeting, and, there's this old-timer sobbing that she can't pray, but I shared about it. And somebody in the meeting said, do you think that you could make a commitment to us, to this meeting, that you would read the 24-hour-a-day page every day? I said, well, yeah, I could do that. And she said, why don't you just do that? I said, okay, I'll do that. Now, I've asked for help, and I've gotten a direction. I'm going to do it. I mean, I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous long enough to know I'm going to do that. And so I started doing that. And, of course, eventually it led me back to being able to pray. Vince always used to say he was sober 2 years longer than me. So if I was struggling with something, let's say I was 20 years sober and I was struggling with something, he'd say, you know, when you're 22, that'll be a lot better. He used to say, so this is totally off topic, but he used to say something else. Somebody said something that really made me think of it, one of the other speakers. When he was referring to the committee and not using the name, Vince used to say when one of his sponsees was speaking at a meeting that Vince was at, he would say to them, okay, I'll be sitting in the fourth row on the aisle there. 5-10 minutes into your talk, just glance over at me. If I'm doing this, don't mention that I'm your sponsor. I'll tell you about one more very recent thing that happened where I kind of forgot about God for a few months. It's kind of insidious because during the story I'm about to tell you, I'm praying every day and I'm feeling kind of connected to God and, you know, I feel like I'm turning my will and my life over. And then this incident happens and I realize finally that maybe I haven't quite been doing that. I leased my condo and I had been living there for 7 years and August a year ago, so like a year and a half ago now, the owner of the condo called me and said, I'm going to have to sell the condo. Would you be interested in buying it? And I said, I'm not in a position to do that. And he said, okay. He said, I'll sign another one-year lease with you, but then we're going to sell it. So I have a year. We signed the lease. I have a year now. And I became crazed with, where am I going to live? I started, I'm on Craigslist. I'm driving up and down streets, writing down phone numbers of places. I'm talking to everybody I know. I'm getting on waiting lists, places, you know, I'm out of my mind. And that was August. And around October, November, it occurred to me that even if I found the perfect place today, I couldn't rent it. I mean, I've got a lease going until next August. What am I doing here? I'm running around like a crazy woman. I've completely forgotten that God's in charge, completely. And so I gave it up. I gave it to God. I completely turned it over. I said, God, you know I'm a little nervous about this, but I am going to let you handle this. So maybe a month later, 2 months maybe, I'm laying by the swimming pool where I live, and I really, really like living where I live. I have my closest friends live in that same complex. I mean, it's like the perfect place, really. And so I'm laying by the pool, and somebody mentioned that their owner was going to be selling, and they were going to have to move, and I mentioned it to my friend Luther, who happens to be the HOA president of the complex that I live in. He talked to the owner and said, have you ever considered a long-term lease? He had not, but any friend of Luther's was kind of his, you know, feeling. He'd be happy to talk to me. Now, again, this is like February. I'm in a lease until August. But he called me, and I went over and looked at the place, and he said, I'd be happy to lease to you. I said, well, I'm in this lease. I can't get out of it. And he said, I will hold it until you are available. That never happens. It wouldn't have happened if I hadn't got out of the way. It wouldn't have happened if I hadn't just said, okay, God, you take it. You know, you take it. I would hope that, you know, events like that would remind me when the next one comes, which it will. I know if something's going to come up where I'm going to be taking the reins and, you know, not letting God handle stuff. You would hope that I would remember this, but I can almost guarantee you that I won't remember it right away. Hopefully I'll remember it eventually, but I will not remember it the first day. I can guarantee you that. You know, I just won't. I get to live this really great life because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of my willingness to take actions that I didn't believe in. You know, those early prayers, God, please help me stay sober today, amen. God, thank you for keeping me sober today. Amen. I didn't feel them. I believed it because I was sober, but I didn't believe that there was anything that was going to answer me or respond or help or that I was ever going to feel anything. And often today when I pray, I feel, not every time I pray, but more often than not, I feel an absolute connection with a higher power. And you gave that to me. You gave it to me. You know, there's a line in the, or a paragraph, I guess it is, in the 12 and 12 that I like. I'm reading it because I can never quote things accurately. Our whole trouble had been the misuse of willpower. We had tried to bombard our problems with it instead of attempting to bring it into agreement with God's intention for us. To make this increasingly possible is the purpose of AA's 12 steps, and step 3 opens the door. It's opened the door for me, and because of it, I get to live this pretty incredible life, and I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. Now let's close with the Lord's Prayer.